This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear about some of the movies that were shown at the 63rd Annual Cannes Film Festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. Held on the French Riviera, Cannes mixes movie star glamour with films from around the world. Our critic at large, John Powers, who is also film critic for Vogue, has been to the festival many times. Yesterday, shortly after he returned, I spoke with him about the festival and some of the winning films he thinks we should watch out for. The jury was headed by Tim Burton. Hi, John. Thanks for coming to talk with us about the Cannes Film Festival. Why don't we start with the film that won the top prize, the Palme d'Or. Tell us about the film.
Yes. The film is by a Thai director with the hard-to-pronounce name of Apichatpong Wirasethakul. And like many Thais, he mercifully goes by a short name, which in this case is Joe. Internationally around the world, everybody talks about Joe's films. The film that he made was one of my very favorite ones of the competition, and probably most critics would love the film a lot. It's called Uncle Bonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. And it is a Buddhist animist tale of a small village guy named Uncle Bonmi. He actually is a farmer, who's dying. And he brings his family together as he dies. And in the process of watching him die, we meet the ghost of his ex-wife. We meet his son, who is now a monkey. We actually have a dream sequence where a princess has sex with a catfish. And we meet various animals along the way. And we're never quite sure which of them is his past lives. But what the story is about is the movement away from life and death, about the borderline between spirit and material life. And what's great about the film is that when you're watching it, you just don't know what's going to happen. It's lovely to look at. It's funny. It's not boastfully self-conscious. It's not shrieking that it's an art movie. It's sort of a dream of a movie that when it finished, it got the biggest applause of the festival. And this was interesting to me because this same director 5 years ago had made a film called Tropical Malady that I remember getting huge amounts of boos. And over the last 6 years, people have begun to get what he does and realize he's this interesting guy who makes movies unlike anybody else in the world.
So what are the odds that we'll get to see this movie in American theaters? Even though it won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, is it likely to play here?
Well, I think what's nice about it is that I think it's likely to play because it won the Cannes Film Festival. It's one of the things about awards that they can elevate the profile of something. In this particular case, you might add that this film won when the jury was headed by Tim Burton. And through much of the week, people kept saying, you know, Tim Burton might actually like this Buddhist animist movie because it's got these furry critters and it's got ghosts and it's got this weird stuff in it. And as it worked out, you know, a very mainstream Hollywood director chose what was, I think, the oddest film in the festival, or his jury chose the oddest film in the festival for the top prize.
The grand prize at the Cannes Film Festival went to a movie called Of Gods and Men. Tell us about that one, John.
Of Gods and Men is a more traditional movie than some of the ones. It's a straightforward narrative, but it's on a really interesting and moving theme. The story is about Cistercian monks in the 1990s who are living in Algeria, and they've been living there among the Muslim community, providing health care and just being the support for that local community. All of a sudden, Islamic terrorists have begun to kill Westerners in the area, and the whole film turns on whether or not they should stay. I guess you would call that the ticking bomb of the story. But what the film is all about is more or less the conflict between the timeless life of the Cistercians, who pray, who chant, who sing, who grow their own honey, with the intrusion of history in a country where history is very difficult, where both the terrorists and the government aren't very likable. And gradually over the course of the thing, you watch the debates about whether or not you should stay and maybe risk your life to stay with the local community or whether you should go. And if you're a Christian, what it means to stay or go. And it's a very quietly gripping, very beautiful film with a sense of spirit. I kept joking to people that if I were the Vatican, I would probably buy 100 million DVDs of this movie and distribute it. Because I think it's maybe the warmest, kindest, most thoughtfully positive presentation of Catholicism I've seen in the media in years.
From what I've read, from what you emailed, it sounds like this wasn't the only film that is about terrorism in one way or another. But before we get to some of the other films on the same theme, I want to hear about the best actor and best actress at the Cannes Film Festival. Best actor, that award was shared with between Javier Bardem and an Italian actor named Elio Germano. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are. Yes, it's one of the funny things that, you know, there are some awards you just don't agree with. And in this particular case, both Javier Bardem and Elio Germano were in two of the worst films of the competition. And part of what makes them bad is that they're so dependent on the brooding, charismatic overacting of the lead performers. But traditionally in these award ceremonies, often the people who are giving the biggest, broadest, most obviously dynamic performances win the acting prize. So in this particular case, to my mind, Javier Bardem, who's a wonderful actor and incredibly charismatic, is quite bad in a film called Beautiful, where he plays the most improbably circumstanced man you could ever think of, which is to say, he's a man who's dying of cancer, who's married to a bipolar wife, who has two jobs. One of his jobs is that he helps Africans sell black market goods. The other one is to provide illegal Chinese laborers to construction sites. And he's poor. And then you add that this is the starting point where the movie's happy, and it goes downhill from there. It's kind of bleak, chic, a bad film. The Italian film that Elio Germano was in is called Our Life. It's about a construction worker whose wife dies and then who tries to go corrupt in order to make money for his kids. Once again, it's a hammy performance. Weirdly enough, the Monk's film contained the actor who should have probably won, a guy by the name of Lambert Wilson, who people might remember from the Matrix movies, who plays the head monk in that film, and also had another big role in a Bertrand Tavernier movie about the religious wars of the 17th century in France. And he was great in both films, but his weren't flashy performances, and generally people like flashy performances.
Did you like the actress who got the Best Actress award, Juliette Binoche, any better than you like the Best Actors?
Yes, well, actually, Juliette Binoche gives a wonderful performance in a film by the Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami.
And he's somebody who you've spoken about before. You really like his film, Taste of Cherry.
A Taste of Cherry, yes. You know, Kiarostami is considered by many people to be the great Iranian director. And what he's done here is for the first time ever made more or less a version of a Western art movie. It's shot in Tuscany, and it stars Juliette Binoche and an English opera singer. It's basically a two-hander about this couple that meets.
What does that mean, John?
A two-hander?
Yeah.
Oh, it means that more or less there are two people who are really the whole film. And he's a writer who she meets, and she's showing him around Tuscany. And gradually, over the course of a day, they go from being strangers to role-playing as if they were married, which is a very precious conceit. And about half the people who saw the film thought it was the worst thing they'd ever seen, and the other half really liked it. It was almost evenly split between cheers and boos. The one thing that I think that everyone agreed on was that Juliette Binoche as the woman is unbelievably good. You know, she's funny. Her emotions are transparent. She provides an energy to the film that keeps it going when it's sometimes too precious for its own good. You know, you just aren't buying what's going on. Would two strangers meet and actually over lunch start pretending that they had been married 15 years ago. But she's so good that no one, I think, would feel cheated by her winning. And in fact, it was made all the easier because she was on the official poster for Cannes this year. So when you walk through the city, Juliette Binoche's face was everywhere. You know, she was inescapable. She probably would have had to give one of the worst performances not to win because she was just so there.
It's understandable, I suppose, that Kiarostami would decide to make a film outside of Iran, considering what's happening in Iran now. And there's an Iranian filmmaker, correct my pronunciation if it's wrong here, named Jafar Panahi who
yes.
was supposed to be on the jury at the Cannes Film Festival, except for the fact that he's in prison in Iran. And he's been on a hunger strike because his request to contact his family and speak with his lawyer has been denied. So he sent a message to the film festival saying, "I swear upon what I believe in, the cinema, I will not cease my hunger strike until my wishes are satisfied. My final wish is that my remains be returned to my family so that they may bury me in the place they choose." What reaction did that get when that message was read?
Many people broke into tears. I mean, because the interesting thing that's going on is that there are, as in every place in the world, there's a huge range of reaction to what's going on in Iran. So that Jafar Panahi is considered to be one of the most daring of the Iranian directors. And he is a protege of Abbas Kiarostami, whose film was in Cannes. And Kiarostami has in general been thought to be relatively mild in his criticism of the government. He's received lots of criticism, whereas Panahi is considered to be probably the bravest of the international ones in that he speaks out. His films are clearly critical of what's going on in Iran. And to my mind, he's probably the best and most interesting person now working in Iranian cinema. And to have him in prison essentially for backing things that, you know, millions of Iranians believe is a very, very powerful thing. And it's all the more powerful because he is someone with an international reputation.
We're talking about the Cannes Film Festival with our critic-at-large, John Powers. We recorded the interview yesterday, right after John returned from the festival. Today, Jafar Panahi was released on bail from prison in Tehran. He'd been held in custody since the beginning of March. The comments at the Cannes Film Festival were just one example of the international campaign to free him. He supports the opposition in Iran. Some of his films are banned there. Panahi's indictment will be sent to a revolutionary court for future action. We'll continue my interview with John about the Cannes Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Powers, our critic at large, and we're talking about what he saw at the Cannes Film Festival. The festival wrapped up over the weekend. John, were there themes at the festival that emerged, themes from the movies?
Yes, there were. I think the great theme is that now we're getting lots of movies about terrorism and not of the dreary kind that came immediately after 9/11, where everybody felt they had to do something. At this year's festival, there were a bunch of films about it. Perhaps the most interesting of them, and certainly the most exciting, was one of the great events of the festival, which was a 5.5-hour screening of a film about the terrorist career of Carlos the Jackal, who terrorism groupies may remember as one of the great terrorists of the 70s and 80s. And it was made by Olivier Assayas, who made a radically different movie that came out in the U.S. last year called Summer Hours, which was about a country house in France and the family dividing it up. This is a vivid, exciting, often thrilling portrait of this unlikable guy, Carlos the Jackal. And we follow his career from him more or less entering the terrorist business in a big way through the peak of his career, you know, kind of his Super Bowl triumph, which was kidnapping all the ministers of OPEC and getting a ransom of $20 million. We get all of that. He becomes a rock star terrorist. And then we then follow him dwindling as the world changes and his terrorist skills have been replaced by a different kind of terrorist skills. So it's this epic sweep story of a guy who's a terrorist. And it's vivid, it's fascinating, it's really fun to watch. It's going to be on Sundance Channel, and IFC is going to be releasing it this fall, so everyone will have a chance to see it. It's in five languages. The lead actor, a guy by the name of Edgar Ramirez, who's a Venezuelan, is great in all five languages. It's a real movie star-making performance for him. And I urge people to see it. I think they'll really, really like it. It's just an exciting movie.
It sounds like this movie will do for him what Quentin Tarantino's movie last year did for, I love this actor and I'm forgetting his name.
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz, exactly. Waltz,
yes. Yeah. Yes, it's interesting when you watch somebody and he's just, because of the people he's dealing with, flipping from English to French to Spanish to Arabic and keeping his performance going and also being very virile and charismatic, because part of the Carlos thing is that when he's not kidnapping people or blowing up innocent civilians, he's drinking lots of scotch and sleeping with German feminists.
Okay, sounds like a very interesting film.
Oh no, it's a very interesting film. And what it does, if I could point this out, is it actually explains how the Middle East worked in terrorism terms, like who's funding who and how it all works.
I was reading about another film whose theme is also terrorism, called Outside the Law. This is a French film.
Yes, Outside the Law is about three Algerian brothers who are fighting for Algerian independence from France in the 50s, in the post-war era. And the story takes place largely in France, where they are what would now be called terrorists, or at least two of them were. And it's very much an old Hollywood movie in which you have three brothers. You have the shifty, energetic one. You have the brainy ideologue. And then you have the fighter who's really honorable. And each of them has a particular skill, and they put it to work for the freeing of Algeria from France. But it's a Warner Brothers movie because it's corny and filled with big emotions, and it's a kind of big-hearted movie that you could imagine having Spencer Tracy as one of the people in, except that in the current climate, it's about people who actually are shooting policemen, blowing up cafes, and all the rest.
So the French right apparently really does not like the film, even though they hadn't seen it. They were protesting it. So what were the protests like at the Cannes Film Festival?
I think I have never seen a protest with more old people in it. It was outside the festival. And
what do you
were
mean when you say the word old?
I mean 80.
Really?
I mean, yes, because in the south of France is one of the places where a lot of the French colonists from Algeria moved after Algerian independence, when they left Algeria. And so the south of France is very National Front territory. There's a politician named Le Pen, who's there. And this is a stronghold for him. But a lot of the feeling of anger about how history is being represented in the film outside the law was felt by people who were a lot older than usual, because these were events that did happen 55 years ago. And so outside the festival, you had all these gray-haired people with protest signs, and then you had the National Guard around. And because these days right-wing terror is as scary to people as Islamic terror in some cases, when we went into the movie theater, you couldn't take in bottles of water. Every single bag you had was thoroughly scrutinized. Normally, they're kind of half-hearted about looking at it, but all of this was checked. And, you know, for me, it was kind of exciting because, as a middle-aged white guy, I'm normally not part of the target group for terrorist screening. They may screen me, but that's only to seem fair. But in fact, in this case, I was the kind of person who they were worried was going to blow the place up.
Because they were worried about the French right?
Yes, they're worried about the French right. They're worried about middle-aged, angry white guys.
Right.
And for all they knew, I could have been one of those middle-aged, angry white guys. You know, they went through my bag with incredible care. You know, they examined my cell phone to make sure that it actually wasn't some sort of detonating device. You know, my friends had their water bottle confiscated, or little gels, or little tiny bottles of moisturizing cream were taken away. In fact, nothing did happen. You know, and of course, the great comedy of all these things is that the people who were so furious hadn't seen the film, and that they were sort of preemptively furious rather than actually being furious on the basis of what they'd seen.
So do you think if they'd seen the film, they'd be as furious?
I think they would probably still be furious, but maybe a little less furious, because the film is, it's not a particularly ideological film. It's more a Warner Brothers movie, as I say. It's melodramatic and filled with big emotions. They probably would be furious because these people wanted to be furious about it. And, you know, like so many things in this country, films that tend to draw lots of fury are attached to issues so much bigger than the film that the film just becomes a pretext for the discussion rather than being the real cause of anything.
So there was an American film that also has a terrorist kind of theme. And I'm thinking of the film about Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson being the former ambassador to Iraq, who wrote a New York Times op-ed saying that he found no evidence that Iraq attempted to purchase yellow cake uranium in Niger. And he accused the Bush administration of exaggerating the Iraqi threat. And then his wife, Valerie Plame, was subsequently outed as a CIA agent, which many people interpreted as payback for Joe Wilson's New York Times op-ed. And Sean Penn is Joe Wilson. Naomi Watts is Valerie Plame. Is this a good film?
It's half a good film. You know, for someone who's lived through, you know, the last 10 years, there's a kind of golden oldies quality to seeing Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame coming back again because, you know, that was a different administration. What the film does is it takes you inside the story in a slightly different way. And for the opening half hour or 45 minutes, it's really wonderful because you actually get to see Valerie Plame doing some spy work. And for me, that's a really interesting thing because somehow she was always just this shadowy figure. But in this movie, you suddenly see her off in Malaysia, you know, bullying people into giving information, or being in Jordan arranging special ops. So that's, you know, that's a very exciting thing. Over the course of the film, as Valerie Plame gets outed, the film becomes a comparatively obvious movie about how the government shouldn't lie and how it's wrong to out CIA agents. And most of the complicated issues of this story get lost along the way in a kind of obvious morality play and a story about their marriage, because we're made to think it was incredibly hard on their marriage to have the media talking about this all the time. But given what's at stake, which is to say war and peace and life and death, the trouble of their marriage doesn't seem important enough, yet the movie moves in that direction. I would just say in passing that if Sean Penn ever had a role that would be his dream role, it's Joe Wilson, which is to say that he gets to be outraged, embattled, opinionated, angry with the media, liberal, and always right. You know, I can imagine when they called him and said, Sean, we'd like you to play Joseph Wilson. He must have said, I am so there, because he is having such fun getting to be that guy. I mean, it was interesting because at the festival, he didn't show up for the film, not because he didn't support the film, but because he was busy in Washington, D.C., testifying before Congress. You know, so Sean Penn, his dream is to be Joseph Wilson.
My guest, John Powers, will talk more about the Cannes Film Festival in the second half of the show. John is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with John Powers about the Cannes Film Festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. John is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue. We've been talking about some of the prize winners at the festival. I asked him if any American films won a prize.
No American films won a prize, but it must be said that there were only a couple of them in competition. You know, this was one of those years where there were movies that Cannes, I'm sure, would have liked to have. There's a new Terrence Malick film coming up, and they just weren't done. And so the American presence was incredibly low this year. There were fewer stars than I ever remember being. There were fewer of the groovy lunches where you go and sit with stars out by the beach and talk to them about their movies. That it was, in some ways, the least star-studded and Americanized festival I can ever remember. You know, in America, we actually like our people to win. Whereas when you're in Cannes, you're reminded of the fact that really all over Asia, people are making movies. All over Europe, people are making movies. And a lot of those movies are good. And that in those countries, their stars don't get much attention because the American stars sort of suck up all the oxygen. Or a movie like Avatar is just everywhere. So for them, it's really exciting to go and realize how much good stuff there is in the rest of the world. And actually, for me, that's the excitement. Is that it's a big world.
Okay, so if the excitement is that it's a global film festival and there's films from Chad and Thailand and, you know, places that we don't usually get to see movies from, why did the festival open with Robin Hood?
Oh, because it's one of the peculiarities of every festival that they want to open with something big and splashy that will get lots of attention. And in this particular case, I think Cannes, which does like having stars and has always liked having stars. I mean, I remember pictures of Grace Kelly and Cary Grant on the red carpet when I was a kid. You know, Cannes has always liked having stars. This year, I think they knew their competition didn't have many stars. So they were so delighted to be able to grab Robin Hood, which is not a good film, to begin with. And to then, on the opening Friday, show the Wall Street movie that Oliver Stone has made as what he refuses to call a sequel to the original Wall Street back in the 1980s.
Well, speaking of Wall Street, how did the economic crisis affect the festival, especially considering what's happening to the euro and how that's affecting European countries?
Well, I think the economic crisis affected the festival in two ways. First, there were fewer films for the festival to choose from. You know, the festival director, Thierry Frémaux, pointed out that a lot of things that might have been, the films that might have been done, somehow hadn't gotten funding. If you recall that when the economy went really bad internationally in 2008 in the fall, that by then, a lot of the films that showed in 2009 had already been financed. It's now 2010, and now is where you feel the year-later effect of the loss of money. So there were just fewer films to choose from, which is, I think, one reason why many people felt it was a weak competition year at the festival. There just weren't as many great films. The second thing is, you know, there were fewer people at the screenings. Each year I feel like someone who is watching, you know, his friends die off almost, or fade away, or move away, because there seem to be fewer Americans there every year. There seem to be fewer people in the screenings. There are fewer big parties. There are fewer big lunches. The glamour is down. I don't think this is an eternal thing, but at the moment you can actually feel that there's an austerity there, that everyone's worried a bit about money.
In the United States, a lot of movie industry executives are saying 3D, is the direction movies are heading in. Everybody's going to go 3D. Did you hear 3D talk at Cannes?
3D is on the one hand, the great mantra for Hollywood. On the other hand, it's like the Freddy Krueger for people around the rest of the world. You know, because, you know, we already live in a position where, at a time where 5% of movies that are made occupy 95% of the screens. And with the growth of 3D, it seems likely to shift that so that an even smaller percentage of films will get even more screen space. You know, because part of the problem with the 3D technology as it now exists is that, one, it costs a lot of money to make, and two, it limits the kind of stories you can tell. Because, you know, what really is the point of having a small-scale but beautiful film about monks if you're just shooting it in 3D and there's no real action sequence in it? So that 3D, in its very technological nature, seems to provoke a certain kind of storytelling, which is antithetical to much of what the storytelling is around the world. And you know, at the festival, you either heard people being really excited because we can now do 3D animation of The Moomins, which is a Finnish fantasy series. That's the excited side, which is the money people. And then the artistic people are all freaking out, thinking that 3D is just going to gobble up all the screens and art movies are going to be even more endangered.
Sure, because if the theaters are equipped for 3D, they're going to want to show movies that are in 3D.
Yes, and I think also what happens is because you get to charge more money for a 3D film, the industry really automatically wants to do it. But then the other thing that happens is once people get more and more used to the look of 3D, then the 2D things start seeming slightly dingier to people in the way that black and white started seeming less appealing to people once they got color. So the technology drives a certain perception of what film is. And as 3D technology gets more and more that way, it's then harder to seem like a real film to lots of younger people in particular if you aren't in 3D. And everyone seems to think that's the future, which is 3D will drive everything. Hmm. And then meager 2D films of the kind that I've spent my entire life watching will have less and less luck and will have a harder time doing it because 3D is very expensive. So, I mean, it remains to be seen. You know, the world's not ending. The sky's not falling. Still, you can actually see how people can be worried.
John, is there a film that we didn't get to that you'd like to talk about before we have to wrap up so that we can keep our eyes open for it, either in the theaters or on DVD?
Yes, a film I really loved was a film called Poetry from South Korea by a director by the name of Lee Chang-dong. And it has a very simple-seeming premise. It's about a woman in her 60s who is retired and on a pension, who works as a maid to help support her grandson. And because her life is slightly boring and looking for something, she decides to take a poetry writing workshop. And the poetry professor tells her she learns to need to see life as it is. And what gradually happens over the next 2 hours is she starts to see that. Her grandson gets involved in a scandal. The way that the parents try to deal with the scandal is kind of nasty. And in fact, she reveals herself over the course of the film to have a much deeper, richer, and bigger inner life than you would have imagined from seeing it. You know, and along the way, she learns to see things that she hadn't seen before. For example, how sexist Korean culture is, how in Korea people try to cover things up using money. And she actually comes to see that maybe her grandson isn't the great kid she thought he was. So it's a movie centered on people writing poetry or trying to write poetry that uses the idea of poetry to take you into a way of seeing the world in a richer and more profound way. I think it was probably one of the two or three most admired films there. It won the screenwriting prize, and it was the best written film at the festival by miles.
John, thank you so much for talking with us. It's always great to talk with you.
Okay. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The law hasn't kept up with new technology. Consider the internet and broadband technology. The Communications Act of 1934 gave the FCC responsibility to oversee phone lines and airwaves. When the law was updated in 1996, it hardly mentioned the internet. Now there's the question of whether internet traffic should be regulated by the FCC, something the telecom industry opposes and many consumer groups and internet companies support. Yesterday, two Democrats, Senator John D. Rockefeller and Congressman Henry Waxman, announced that they plan to hold meetings next month to begin the process of updating the Communications Act so that it directly addresses broadband service. Amy Schatz covers technology policy and the FCC for The Wall Street Journal. We asked her to explain why this issue is important and what's at stake. Amy Schatz, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we get to the details of what each side wants, frame the debate for us. What are the principles that are being fought over now regarding regulation of the Internet?
Well, this comes down to an issue that's been bubbling in D.C. for a while and around the country, and it's this idea of net neutrality. And the idea of net neutrality is really what kind of regulations can be on the Internet. What can phone and cable companies do to your Internet lines? And can they do anything to your traffic? Or is basically the idea here is that who's going to control those lines that go into your house? And there's never really been any rules that sort of talk expressly to Internet lines, because we've always kind of relied on rules that were on phone. But it really gets into a really big issue as more Americans use the Internet to either make phone calls or watch movies or just connect with their kids and email and things like that. And so it's becoming a really, really big issue.
So it's kind of like, who controls the Internet? Is it the phone companies? Is it the government? Is it the FCC? And the communications laws that we have, do they say anything about that?
Yeah, the communications laws we have were actually made in the 1930s, so, and they've been updated a few times since then, but even the last time they were rewritten was back in 1996, and the Internet was barely even around at that point, and it wasn't really mentioned in the law. And so the laws that they're relying on now are so old and really aren't written for the Internet. So that's one of the issues that they've been running into as they've tried to apply these rules to these new Internet lines, is that they weren't really written for those. They were written for the very specific things that happened with phone lines or cable lines. And so that's where they're running into a lot of problems, because this was just never meant to be this way. And they were never meant to try to apply them this way. And so it's just been a very awkward fit.
So let's get to the FCC. What is the FCC considering doing in terms of regulating the Internet?
So they're basically talking about regulating Internet lines. And there's a difference between, because the FCC will, the FCC chairman gets really sort of offended when people say, oh, he wants to regulate the Internet. Well, they're really talking, and there's a difference, because there are lines that Internet traffic go over, and then there's the Internet traffic. And so they're really talking about the lines, the physical lines that come into your house, or the little airwaves that are coming into your cell phone or your iPhone. They're basically talking about just ensuring that there are rules in place that prevents companies from discriminating against other companies' traffic. And so that if there's data coming into your house, Comcast can't mess with it, and they can't block you from doing things. They can't slow the traffic to make your experience really bad. And so the FCC has basically proposed some rules to give them power to stop that kind of behavior from happening.
So the position the FCC is in now and trying to decide if and how it will try to regulate the Internet, it's connected to a suit that the FCC lost, where the FCC had challenged Comcast, and then Comcast challenged the FCC. Would you describe what that case was about?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, there was a network engineer named Rob Topolsky, and Rob was trying to download some movies or music or something via these peer-to-peer sharing services like BitTorrent, where it's just a way to share really large files. So anyway, say Rob was having problems downloading something. And so being a network engineer and actually understanding how to do this stuff, he looked into it and figured out that Comcast was blocking traffic, and that they were actually not necessarily blocking, but they were doing something very technical to slow traffic, and it was just causing him not to be able to download stuff. And this was happening across the country. And so a group of sort of public interest groups investigated this and concluded that, in fact, Comcast was slowing traffic. And so they filed a complaint with the FCC, and the FCC looked into it and said, yep, Comcast wasn't telling anybody what was going on, and they were deliberately slowing traffic. And so they basically slapped Comcast on the wrist and said, you're not allowed to do this, and because you're violating our net neutrality principles, and cut it out. And so Comcast said, well, the FCC didn't kind of go through all the administrative stuff that you have to go through to sanction somebody. And they took them to court and they said, look, the FCC doesn't have rules. And they only had these like weird principles they came up with years ago. and you can't do this to us. And a district court recently concluded that, in fact, Comcast was right. The FCC had not done what they should have been doing to sort of adequately enforce their principles, because you can't enforce a principle. You can only force a rule. It's very complicated. But bottom line is the court basically said, you know, the FCC, you're going to have to come back to us and explain this to us and justify what you do a little bit better.
So the court didn't say that the FCC has no authority to do this. It said it took the wrong approach, and it needs
exactly.
to come back and figure out a better approach if it wants to ensure net neutrality.
Exactly. They just basically said you need to do a do-over, that, you know, the way you tried it didn't work for us, and that if you want to try to do this again, you know, knock yourselves out, but you got to try to find it, do it a different way. And that's what the FCC is trying to do.
So what are some consumer groups' fears about the Internet being controlled by the phone companies with no regulation?
So for net neutrality, it comes down to two issues. And for consumer groups, they're really concerned that the Comcasts and the AT&Ts of the world are going to restrict what consumers can do in their homes and what they can access on the Internet. So there's a fear that if Comcast cuts a deal with Amazon, that you may not be able to buy a book from Barnes & Noble as easily as you could buy it from Amazon.com. You know, it's not necessarily happening right now, but there's a fear that if you give too much power to the phone and cable companies over the lines that are coming into consumers' homes, that that could be really bad for consumers and it will restrict consumer choice.
And a lot of Internet companies want some regulation as well, companies like Google, for instance, and Amazon. So what are their concerns?
That gets to the other side of the net neutrality debate, because I've always considered this sort of two-pronged thing here. One is the consumer side, and the other side is really the business side. And companies like Amazon or Google or eBay don't want phone companies putting up toll booths, basically, in between them and consumers. And they don't want the Comcast of the world or AT&T or whomever to be able to charge them more to reach you. And so they want to make sure that the FCC or somebody is in the way to prevent that from happening and really changing the way that the Internet has acted in the past, which is the Internet was designed at sort of this best effort system, which is that, you know, they're going to make the best effort they can to get little packets to your PC, but they don't really guarantee the delivery of those little packets. And so, you know, one of the things that the phone and cable companies have been looking at is trying to offer sort of guaranteed delivery, which would be sort of like a UPS overnight service versus just your regular mail service. And, you know, so there are pros and cons to that, but the Internet companies like Google are really concerned that they're going to get hit up for extra money on the back end.
Okay, meanwhile, the telecom companies don't want any regulation. What are their concerns?
One of the reasons why is because, you know, these networks, the Internet, the way it was built, it's a fairly complicated thing, and they don't want government regulators coming in and telling them how they can, you know, run their lines or what they can do with their lines. You know, we went through a couple of years ago, the FCC was looking into this issue, and there was this big public hearing out at Stanford. And during this hearing, it was like 3-4 hours long. And in the middle of it, you know, you had all these FCC commissioners who were basically, you know, some of them are lawyers, some not. And they were listening to all these network engineers try to explain to them how packets would go over these Internet lines and these networks and pinging and all this other stuff. And it got to the point where, you know, I cover this stuff. I'm pretty good at this. But even I was hopelessly lost. And you could see every FCC commissioner was hopelessly lost, too. This gets really, really complicated. And so, you know, for the phone companies or the cable companies who are basically trying to sell you the service and make as much money as they can off the service, they don't want the government coming in and telling them, well, you have to run your packet this way or something, because they're concerned that government won't be able to keep up with industry and what they're having to do with these networks as they're trying to grow them and make your speed faster.
I think one of the concerns of the telecom companies is that they've made investments in the Internet based on the premise that the government wouldn't regulate it. Now they think it's unfair that those investments might be compromised in some way if the government changes their mind and decides it's going to regulate the Internet.
And that's the major concern. It sort of depends. It's a sort of a matter of degrees and how much control does the government want to have over what kind of practices they are doing. And so, you know, if you listen to some of the lobbying and you listen to some of the hand-wringing that's going on with Comcast and everybody, they're saying that basically the FCC wants to run all their lines. You know, they want to run all the network traffic and do all this stuff. And that's not necessarily the case. Basically, what the FCC and the Obama administration are really saying is that, you know, somebody has to be the cop on the beat here. Someone has to have the authority to stop bad practices if they start happening. And if that's the case, then it needs to be the FCC.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more about net neutrality. My guest is Amy Schatz of The Wall Street Journal. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Amy Schatz of The Wall Street Journal. She has been reporting for about 5 years on the telecom industry, tech policy, and the FCC, and we're talking about net neutrality, which is basically the requirement that internet providers treat all net traffic equally and not charge more for certain transmissions. As the FCC is trying to figure out what, if anything, it wants to do on the issue of net neutrality, it's also dealing with a big report, a 360-page report it released in March on what's wrong with the with U.S. broadband and with proposals for expanding internet service. What are some of the things that we should know about that are proposed in that report?
So the idea of this was that there's a general feeling that the U.S. is falling behind in internet, and that although we have more subscribers to the internet than I think anyone in the world, if you look at it on a per capita basis, that we're really more down in the 15th, about 15th in the world range. And so there's a thought that, you know, we need to do something to make sure that every American can get online at a pretty fast rate of speed and that it's not too expensive for them. And so I think really the two main things that they really talked about in this report was that they need more airwaves because more Americans are using cell phones as internet browsers. You know, you often replace your laptop or your PC at home with looking at things on your iPhone or your other smartphone. And as anybody who has an iPhone in an urban area can tell you, there can be some congestion sometimes, and you might need a few more airwaves out there. And so the FCC said, you know, we really need some more airwaves because the growth in this is going to explode. If you think it's bad now, it's going to get 10 times worse in the next couple of years. And so they said, well, we have to find some more airwaves. And one big chunk of airwaves that they think would suit quite well for this would be the airwaves that are being used right now by a lot of TV broadcasters. Because TV broadcasters got great airwaves because they wanted to make sure that everybody could see the TV and that you could watch TV in your basement if you wanted to. And so the TV broadcasters gave up, you know, a lot of airwaves a couple years ago when we all transitioned to digital TV. But the FCC says that they could probably give up a few more, especially in urban areas along the East Coast and other areas where, you know, you are seeing a lot of congestion. The other big thing they said was, like, you know, we really have to change this federal subsidy plan that we have, which pays for phone service. It subsidizes phone service in really rural areas where it can cost you an unbelievable amount of money to reach a ranch or something. And so they said, you know, look, this is great. We've been using this for phone lines, but this is crazy because most people are using wireless phones now. And so we should really change this plan to pay for broadband instead. The other big thing here is that they're going to say, well, look, this fund is $8 billion a year, and it's paid for by everybody out of their phone bill. It's called a USF fee. And the USF fee is like $1 or $2 on every phone bill every month. And they're going to use that money instead of paying for phone lines or to subsidize phone lines. They're going to subsidize broadband instead.
Would you say we're at a turning point now and that that America is on the verge of deciding what the future of the internet is going to look like?
It is in a lot of ways. And I think one thing that a lot of folks really feel like, they just want faster, more reliable, cheaper broadband lines. You know, it's gotten to the point where if you don't have broadband in your house, you're falling behind. You know, I live in the District of Columbia, and I realized this week that I can't even go to the DMV anymore to re-register my car. I can only do it online. And they're increasingly across the country, people are finding this, and that if you don't have broadband service, people aren't going to come to your community. They're not going to move there if they can't get decent broadband. And so it's something that so many Americans now rely on broadband. It's just an integral part of their lives, whether it's for keeping in touch with their kids or, you know, watching the news or just finding out what's going on or playing games or whatever. You know, it's just hard to imagine at this point, you know, going back to a pre-internet world.
So that raises the question, should the internet be like a public utility since people rely on it for their job searches, their home searches, their news reading, their communications with family?
Yeah, and that kind of gets back to the idea of net neutrality, too, which is this idea that, you know, it is a public good and it is sort of like a public utility, even though it was paid for by private companies, and that someone has to be there to ensure that people have access to it. And, you know, the FCC is sort of struggling with this a little bit, but they're trying to sort of figure out a way to make sure that people in parts of the country who don't have internet access right now, and there are a lot of people out there, probably about 23% of, I think it was 23% of households don't even have internet, high-speed internet service. They're still 1 megabit per second or less in terms of speed, which is practically crawling at this point. You can barely get on some of these internet sites if you don't have, if you've got speed that slow. And so, you know, one of the things the FCC is really trying to do is sort of bring this up to a public utility level with this idea that it's important to have electricity and it's important to have running water and it's really important to have internet service. And they're sort of elevating it to that level.
Well, Amy Schatz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Amy Schatz covers tech policy and the FCC for The Wall Street Journal. You can find links to the full text of her recent Wall Street Journal articles about net neutrality on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhevar, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.